It's 2:47 a.m. in the Southern Reach, and you're listening to Night Call.
Hi, I'm Tess Lynch in Los Angeles, and with me are
Molly Lambert.
And in New York, I'm Emily Yoshida.
Welcome back to Night Call, you guys. We have a very exciting podcast for you today, but we are going to kick off with the most important topic, which is
Kim Kardashian, always.
Otaku.
Kim Kardashian otaku. Notice me, senpai. Kim Kardashian has been doing a lot of Instagram posting recently since having her baby, Chicago. And people have been noticing that they're sort of increasingly thirst trappy with what she's been doing, where it's just like something more crazy each time or more trying to get attention-y. People are surmising that she feels insecure about Kylie surpassing her as the number one Kardashian and now also the number one Kardashian mom. So,
well, actually, there's only one number one Kardashian mom, and you know it's Kris.
The OG. She's not a Kardashian.
It's true, but let's be real.
She's the ultimate.
She's the queen.
I thought you were going to say Courtney.
No, but I do love Courtney.
I was like, Courtney's the only one who seems like maybe chill and a good mom. And
secretly chill.
I feel a little disconnected from things because I can't understand how anybody, especially somebody within her own family, would find Kylie's circumstances and motherhood right now to be in any way enviable. But that's just
sexy.
Me.
It's sexy to have a baby when you're a billionaire.
Isn't it?
Billionaire babies. They're boss babies. Baby.
Just to prove you can do it.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, I'm trying to be open-minded, but she did put a Snapchat filter on the first picture of the baby, and I was like, this baby is doomed.
Yeah.
Don't you say that about all the babies at various points? Like, didn't we probably say that about Kendall and Kylie in, like, the first season of Keeping Up with the Kardashians?
Again, like, now I'm like, that's so, like, they didn't have a Snapchat filter on their infant photos. That really made me go, huh?
Yeah.
We're in a new world now.
Yeah.
I saw a story the other day that was about people bringing in Snapchat filter selfies to plastic surgeons. It's apparently really common now.
Jesus. And they come out with roses growing on their foreheads.
Yes.
And sparkles and spangles on their
weird
eyes.
Like dilated pupils.
Yeah. They're like, I want to look like I look. Make me look like this deer filter. I want to be a deer. So Kim Kardashian posted on her Instagram, she now has pink hair. That's her new Instagram stunt, is that she got pink hair. And she posted a picture of an anime babe with pink hair and said, this was my inspiration.
Yep.
And Emily, I'll defer to you as the expert anime podcaster.
Yeah.
What do you think it means?
What do I think it means? Well, I mean, I think we discussed this maybe on a group chat that... Obviously, well, I mean, I won't rule out the fact that Kim enjoys herself some anime on her own, but I feel like definitely Kanye has made her watch Akira at some point. That has definitely happened at some point in their relationship. And where she chose to go with her fandom and interest in the medium from there is, you know, anyone's guess. But I do think that right now I would be more shocked about Kim embracing anime or even taking style cues from anime at any other time. But right now I feel like it is, there's a wave right now of celebrities coming out of their otaku closets.
But aren't you glad about it? Because at least it's like reclaiming it back from the alt-right, who we were concerned had sort of taken over anime avatars.
Yes.
They try to take over everything, but they're not taking anime.
Yes. I mean, I am 100% for that. I'm 100% for Michael B. Jordan talking about Naruto in an interview. I mean, it's very endearing.
Or are you such a snob that you're like, it devalues my Naruto fandom now that all the
I don't give a fuck about Naruto. Like, he can have it, but it's still very sweet. Like, and I like to imagine, like, just, I mean, it could be Frasier, you know. I like to imagine beautiful celebrities at home watching Netflix, watching, you know, Pokemon or whatever in their free time. That's very, that makes me feel like I, you know, they're one of us.
You have a generous spirit.
Well, I mean, I don't, it's hard for me to be snobby about anime because I'm like, you know, I've explained this. I used to explain this on the podcast that I used to have, but I'm not like a, like, expert by any means. I don't know what that character is that Kim posted, and I didn't look it up actually in time for this podcast, which I probably should have done. But, you know, it's cool. Like, I don't know. I'm not mad at it. And I feel like it's just a outgrowth of the fact that all these shows are so much easier to watch now than they were, like, when we were teens.
Back in the day.
Yeah. So, you know, it's accessible and it just can, like, you know, absorb itself into the culture a little more easily than it could have a while ago. Which is fine and cool. I like it.
Well, last week we talked about Phantom Thread, but not in time for the podcast. Molly got a text from her friend illuminating a theory that we all thought was really interesting. So we wanted to just jump back so that we could kind of explore this theory.
So, Phantom Thread theory time. Friend of the podcast, Gil Keenan, who is also a director from the San Fernando Valley, told me that he had a Phantom Thread theory he would let me in on after I saw the movie. So when I asked him what it was, I will read it. He texted it to me. He said, oh, just that Alma is a camp survivor. Her parents were killed there. She made it to England after the war, and the recent memory of the loss is what makes her so strangely numb, but also equipped to handle Woodcock and his Gestapo sister. Also, she becomes weirdly animated by the disrespect that the old rich lady shows to the dress after the press conference scene where the press asks the fiancé about his family's involvement in a scandal involving Jewish visas.
Ooh.
And I wrote back, oh, it's the night porter, which is my answer to everything.
It was interesting to kind of, I think Molly dived deep, as did I, into the into finding ways to justify this theory. But I'll let Molly go first. And Emily, I bet you have your own thoughts. But it was thought-provoking because that the Jewish visas thing really stood out in the movie as being like very specific information that was kind of dropped and then not really revisited. So I think it stuck out to all of us as being kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, also if Paul Thomas Anderson wants to call us and be like, you know nothing of my work, like,
yeah. Please,
we just
give us a night call.
Yeah,
we like to theorize, but you know, I'm also willing to accept that this might not be true at all. But Emily, what did you think?
Well, I mean, I really like the theory. I think it would explain. I think it would explain her resistance to Reynolds and Cyril. If she was forced into this situation, like if she was hired as a maid or something like that. But she's, you know, she's drawn to it herself. It's not just a resisting of a thing. It's like she's actually attracted to their Gestapo ways.
Well, that's where the night porter comes in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. So I feel like, I don't know. I would need a little more psychological backup there as far
she
as that
said
goes.
She could stand forever.
Yeah.
Because she has the resilience.
Well, Tess did, as the Robert Graysmith, Tess did a lot of real research and came back with like much information that supports this theory.
I don't know if it supports the theory, but there's some interest. I kind of went down a rabbit hole and found like some weird threads, if you will. So one thing that I found that was interesting from Nylon, it doesn't address the you know, Holocaust in particular, but it is interesting vis-a-vis that scene. So it the article says, one of Woodcock's most important clients is the heiress Barbara Rose. Anderson gives Harris only 4 scenes in the Phantom Thread, and they're not long in terms of length, but it seems that Barbara Rose is like a message stitched into the fabric of the narrative, and her appearance feels crucial to understanding the rather obscure meanings of the movie. Oh, yes, it does. So basically, though her first name is Barbara, you know, it didn't occur to me that Harris was playing a role based on the Woolworth heiress Barbara Hutton until her second scene. This is all quoted from Nylon, by the way, where Anderson stages Barbara Rose's humiliating press conference announcing her marriage to a noted playboy who is clearly meant to be the infamous Porfirio Rubirosa. So then there's a Vanity Fair profile on Rubirosa. It says that he was unable to return to his country because he was basically, you know, he had been selling Dominican visas to Jews wishing to flee Europe and had been kind of found out. And Barbara Hutton was the poor little rich girl that would, you know, every poor little rich girl movie and book has been based on. So she was kind of like a sad sack. I think she got married six times or something. And at one point was married to Cary Grant. Like, she was a really kind of bizarre and like sad person who squandered her fortune.
Yeah, this is the thing I was talking about last week, but I couldn't remember the names of them. So yeah, there's a lot of further reading on Barbara Hutton and Porfirio on the internet to be found. I think several people, I think there's a piece on Vanity Fair about it as well.
Yes, that was, there was a Vanity, there's a Nylon piece and the Vanity Fair piece about Barbara Hutton too. I also found some interesting things about people who were sewing secret messages into needlework while they were in Nazi camps. There was a guy named Alexis Castelli, and he would add secret messages to the stuff that he was sewing in Morse code around, you know, some piece of needlework. He wrote "fuck Hitler," and then there was also the case that there were like all of these women who were working under Hedwig Hoess, who was the wife of a concentration camp commander. And she had a dressmaking workshop where they would do haute couture and kind of like make these gowns for you know, Nazi events. And there was a book about it that I guess then was adapted into a young adult novel by a woman named Lucy Adlington. But it said that there's a, I pulled a quote from an article in the Express about this, but it says, the clients even came to the concentration camp camp workshops for fittings and consultations, all part of what Adlington calls the repulsive mock civilization of the Nazi regime. One of the Auschwitz seamstresses, a Slovakian dressmaker named Lulu Gruenberg, could barely control her resentment at the indifference and arrogance of the women for whom she was making clothes to survive.
Wow. Hey, that's just super interesting.
I went way down the hole on this.
That also sounds like that does sound like made for a novel also. I believe that there is a novel based on that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm also like, make a movie about that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Somewhere in the article, they said they were sewing for their lives. Like, they were trying to prove their talent and, like, you know, worth to be kept around. And
all the Nazi things where they made people, like, do creative stuff to, like, prove that they should survive. Like, the musicians, mm-hmm. you know? It's fucking, that's the scariest
thing. It is the scariest thing.
I don't know why. Yeah. I mean, I do know why.
It's strange that all of, I mean, it's interesting that you can kind of find these weird, you know, articles that seem to relate to the phantoms. I mean, it's definitely about a certain time, and then you get into like the seamstresses and the hidden messages being sewed into things. But it was interesting, the passport or the visa line being like this weird clue, and yeah. You think you're gonna follow it and find something concrete, but it is a phantom thread. It's merely a phantom thread.
So let's take a night call. And as always, if you want to leave us a night call, you can give us a call at 1-240-46-NIGHT. That's 1-240-46-NIGHT. Or you can email us at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com, whichever method you prefer is A-okay with us. And just leave us your questions, theories, comments, just your thoughts, and we will we'll address them on air. So we have a call today about a little movie that I think we've all seen. Let's see.
Hey, this is Charlie in Texas. It is 12:05 a.m., true night call hours. I just got out of a screening of Annihilation, which fucking ruled. Everyone should go see it. But I noticed this is like the third time in a row where I've seen a movie and Jennifer Jason Leigh randomly popped up, and it made the movie a lot better. So I was wondering if there's any actors or actresses that you guys see randomly pop up in movies that you know will bring a good time. All right, thanks.
So I really appreciate Charlie's PSA to go see Annihilation, a movie that I quite like. Spoiler alert. But I fear that it might be a little too late for it, seeing as I think it's like maybe still in 5 theaters in the United States by the time you're hearing this podcast. But yes, Jennifer Jason Leigh is in it. She's very scary and weird in it. And I'm a fan of Jennifer Jason Leigh. I feel
who
like
she isn't.
I feel like she rarely pops up though. I'm usually very aware that Jennifer Jason Leigh is going to be a movie before I see it.
I had a spooky experience because I had no idea she was in this movie, and my mind was wandering, and I was for some reason thinking about like, hey, it's so weird that Noah Baumbach was married to Jennifer Jason Leigh and is now dates Greta Gerwig. And then, like, as I was thinking it was like, then she appeared
on
screen.
You willed her to appear
on
screen.
I willed her. And I, like, was so weirded out because I was like, I don't normally just think about Jennifer Jason Leigh.
But oh,
I
don't
was,
lie.
I was also, I was so happy to see her. And she really brought me back into the movie.
She was fantastic in that. But wait, what actors are you guys always happy to see?
Luis Guzman.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. I kept trying to think of people, and I just ended up coming back to everybody in the Paddington movies. Jim Broadbent is a big one for me. I love a Jim Broadbent cameo / appearance. You know who used to be one for me? Or like, I mean, he is no longer with us, RIP. But when he appears in kind of a, if I'm watching an oldie or some, you know, kind of B-list thing I've never seen before, if Pete Postlethwaite shows up in something, I'm always really into that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that also leads us into this Danny Boyle conversation.
Can I say mine?
Yes.
Because I have two.
Sorry, Danny Boyle affiliated.
Yes. Yeah. Mine are Martin Mull, because he was in an episode of Taxi, and he was also in an episode of The Golden Girls. And, like, I remember both of them, and then I was looking. I was like, oh, you know, what's his Wikipedia? And it's just, like, full of those things. And then also Richard Mazur.
Have you ever seen Fernwood Tonight?
No.
That is the best show in the world. and kind of what I want Night Call to be like.
What
it's
is
like a
Fernwood
spinoff
Tonight?
Of Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I'll say. Okay. Fernwood Tonight. That's what Night Call is very Fernwood Tonight inspired.
Let's talk Annihilation.
Let's
though. We
talk
all
about
saw
Annihilation. I wish Martin Mull had been in Annihilation.
I do. He should have. Maybe he was. Maybe he was the double.
Emily, I'm going to break your heart right now.
Okay, go for it.
Tess and I did not love Annihilation we as much not. As you did, I think.
Well, I you
Tess,
know.
Tess actively disliked it. I was more kind, I think. I liked a lot of things about it, and I thought about it a lot afterwards.
Yeah, me too.
We also saw it at 11 in the morning.
That's the best time to see any movie. I'm a huge fan of watching movies in the morning. Your mind is open. You're not all tired and jaded yet, so, you know.
I feel like this was more of a Night Call movie, a movie you might want to watch at night.
Well, yeah. I mean, for sure.
Spoiler alert about the swirling guts scene in this movie is
that
hard
was the
at
best.
11:20 in the morning, but it in a way it made us appreciate it more, I think, because our guts were still swirling with breakfast, and then we're like, oh, look at that.
That's when I turned to Tess and I went, I'm in.
Yeah. It's true.
Tess is also not swayed by the charms of Oscar Isaac like some of us might be.
Look, I appreciate his acting. It's a purely, it's a sexual preference. Like,
can you
I'm
check
just
her
not,
pulse right now? Oh my God.
I know.
You're not sexually attracted to young Al Pacino?
He's just not my, well, I didn't say that specifically. I said Oscar Isaac. There's just something, I guess because I know everyone else feels that way, I'm like, well, let them have him. But I appreciate his acting, although he didn't do much in Annihilation, which was great. It was a female-dominated sci-fi movie, which is fantastic.
Everybody was really excited before the movie came out because he was only billed as being the husband in the IMDb, and everybody was like, yes, Oscar Isaac is the husband.
Yeah, it was weird how much, I mean, first of all, I'm glad Tess and I both saw it because there's no way you could possibly explain this movie in the amount of time we have on a podcast to each other and also to the audience.
So we should probably decide what level of spoiler we want to go with it, because I mean, my favorite aspect of it is the end, and that's the part that I could talk about the most.
Well, let's hope we'll get there. So Annihilation is a sci-fi movie about a team of scientists going to a area you're not supposed to go to, some sort of contaminated area.
It's called Area X. I feel like the distinction is sort of weird in the movie. In the book, it's all called Area X. They also call it the shimmer in the movie, but they also refer to Area X as like maybe a region that contains the shimmer. It's very strange.
Mm-hmm. It's like a weird southern swamp.
Yeah, it's supposed to be in Florida somewhere. It's based on a book by Jeff Vandermeer. There was a trilogy of books that is based on the first one, but it's very much meant to just be a self-contained movie, I think.
Yeah, and it's different. It's very different from the book, supposedly. Yes. But there are some things that are the same. Tess and I both brought notes.
We did.
Great. Can't wait.
It made me want to go home and watch Tarkovsky's Stalker, which I did.
Oh, yeah.
And then my friend gave me a hard time about watching Stalker on a laptop. And I was like, but I was really close to the screen. So, there's a lot going on.
You have a projector at home.
Yeah, but I was I was watching it by myself. Like,
too much work.
You know, it was great. It was super enjoyable for me. And then I was reading about Soviet sci-fi all night long.
Yeah, man.
Which is the best.
Well, Stalker is the only movie that Alex Garland, the director, has owned up to being inspired by, because he, I think understandably bristles at like the thing of like, what things were you lifting for your movie? Because I think especially people who are trying to do like newish sci-fi, you want to feel like you're trying to. Like,
yeah, it's a tribute / ripoff of Stalker.
Yeah. But that's the one thing he was like, yeah, Tarkovsky, definitely.
It's a trip off.
Yeah.
And also Solaris, which is the other Tarkovsky movie.
Which I saw recently. I saw like a beautiful new.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah. Stalker, there's also like a new Criterion print of it that's fucking awesome. But Solaris, which is based on a novel by the Polish writer Lem Stanislaw, is sort of invented the sci-fi concept of like the aliens being like, instead of being little gray men or tall grays or little green men, it's like a planet or like a gas.
It's like a consciousness.
It's like a consciousness, and you like can't communicate with it at all because it's so foreign. Yeah. The Solaris is a planet that watches you.
It's a state of mind.
Yeah. So yeah, Tess and I both really like a lot of the ideas that are in Annihilation. I just felt like the characterization and dialogue was like, fell really flat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that it's hard because you kind of place all your hopes on, when you see five women who are scientists, or I mean, I guess one is an EMT, but I mean, they're five strong women who are not like being shepherded by a man or being sent on this mission by a man. In fact, like, you know, Dr. Ventress, who's Jennifer Jason Leigh, she's kind of portrayed like it's a shame that you would normally see men playing these roles, but I felt as though they could have intellectualized them more. And I was telling Molly that it made me really nostalgic for the original Jurassic Park and Ian Malcolm, because I remember reading the book and seeing the movie, the explanation of the science and his, you know, drive to kind of wrap his mind around it, was a lot of screen time was devoted to him kind of unpacking it. And I felt as though that was something that was kind of neglected, and I don't know if it is in the book as well, but we're just supposed to accept that, okay, so DNA is refracted like through a prism. And it's like, but what does that mean? And then you see that it can, you know, you can kind of transfer your DNA via touch, that you become contaminated, your DNA is seeping out all over the place and mingling with plants and becoming a fungus. And I thought it was interesting, but it seemed like not satisfying to not have at least one of these very accomplished scientists trying to give a more thorough explanation. Like, it felt like a blind spot that we were just expected to accept. And that it bothered me.
Well, the only one of them who is a scientist who would be equipped to explain it is Natalie Portman's character, who's a biologist. The other ones are...
No, there's a physicist.
Oh, the physicist. Yeah, yeah.
Tessa Thompson.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, then there's also a psychologist or I don't know if she's a psychologist or psychiatrist, but I mean...
Also psychologist, yeah.
Spoiler alert, it's weird that the physicist gets the biology death.
Exactly, yeah. Yes.
And Tessa and I were also bothered that Tessa Thompson's character, who turns into a plant...
Spoilers.
Spoiler. They don't show you that she turned into a plant.
No money
shot. She just kind of wanders off. Then you never see her again, and it's very creepy and Wicker Man-y, but you're also just like waiting for like the shot
the
of
money
her
shot.
As a plant, and they don't show it. And then, I don't know. Well, really wanted to see it. Also made me want her to play Poison Ivy.
Yes.
Well, so the thing about the book is that they actually have more character fleshing out in the movie than they do in the book. They're pretty much like ciphers
We saw it with a friend who had read the book, and he was like, there are even more like ciphers in the book.
They don't have names in the book. They're just called, well, they're different positions too. They have like the surveyor, the anthropologist, the linguist is one of them. There's no linguist in this one, which is because the whole thing that the linguist is interested in is not in the movie, which is one of the bigger things that I miss from the movie that's in the book. But I kind of bristle against this idea, and this has come up multiple times, and I feel like I haven't had like a forum to talk about it, or like haven't had the time, or I don't know. But like I kind of bristle against this idea of like this should be a movie about strong female scientists. I don't think that that's what this movie is about.
It's not the movie's fault either.
But it's fun to watch. It's fun to think about the portrayal of five female scientists
What's also funny is like when I was watching it, I like never thought about the fact that they were all women. Yeah. They're just like regular people.
Right. And they're just like, we're going to try something different. The last few expeditions have been men and we haven't done it with all women yet. So we're just going to see how it goes. And it's like, cool.
But then there was a point where they all came out in the suits and I was like, oh no, they're Ghostbusters. Yeah. You know, because it's not their fault or it's not this movie's fault. It stresses me out because I'm like, if this movie fails,
exactly.
Or if like A Wrinkle in Time, you know, fails, like, are we ever going to get any more female sci-fi ever again? Or are people going to be like, female sci-fi doesn't sell. Let's never sell it.
I mean, like last, you know, like Arrival was my favorite movie of that year. That was like a very successful movie and got nominated for awards and stuff and is very much told. That's like a developed, I feel like, scientist character dealing with something uncanny, an alien. If you want something that has like, that's a little more of a character study as opposed to this, which I feel is much more, like it's like, it is like those Tarkovsky movies where I don't think you have a gripe about those movies that you wish the like the main dude character that you knew more about him as like, a professional.
You do kind of know more about him. About
I mean,
no, but I mean, like in the mold of a movie like Aliens or Predator, which was the things I mainly was thinking about.
Yeah,
it's like,
sure.
How much do you need to develop those characters that you know are all going to get killed off?
Well, I mean, I think that I'm guessing, Emily, that you would agree that the Crosby, Stills, and Nash flashbacks to
that made Tess so mad.
Helplessly Hoping was really rough. I mean, that was a. Like,
but you know why it was used, though, right?
No, tell me.
Oh, come on. There are four people, or no, they're two people. They are three together. They are four. It's about cell division.
Right, okay.
It's great.
I'll buy it. I can't watch a woman crying on a sofa. It's against my religion.
Wow.
When the song plays. I won't do it again.
I was brought up CSN. Wait, how can I even pronounce this?
Like
CSNY. CSN and Sometimes Why.
Yeah.
I want to say, you know, the best parts of this movie reminded me of Angel's Egg a little bit. And sometimes I was like, I kind of wish this were just an anime and I wouldn't be
I
so
wish
concerned.
It was just an anime, honestly. I mean, I think some of the design of it is cool, but I didn't 100% love the aesthetic.
No, I feel the same way. And there was a moment where I had like a false revelation that turned out to not be true, where when you know, the whole end is very cool. It turns into like a Jodorowsky movie in a way that is like made it worth seeing for me, definitely. And when she's in the like, there's like the bone fungus all
should
over
we say
swimming
that we're,
pool.
We're, we haven't really even
spoilers
talked about
ahoy.
The plot that much, but
yeah.
We should probably
spoilers
warn that we're
ahoy.
Going into
she
spoiler
goes,
territory. So.
She goes in a hole in a like a lighthouse with like a skeleton fungus that's growing everywhere. That's very scary. And then she gets in there and it's like an H.R. Geiger drain pipe. And then she finds Jennifer Jason Leigh or like an alien Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is letting the alien presence basically take over her body or like use
and
her body.
And then Jennifer
host.
Jason Leigh goes, Annihilation! Mortal Kombat!
I mean, it's sort of funny because annihilation is also like a significant word uttered by that character in the book, but it's...
No,
it's,
read. It makes a lot more sense in the book, but it's one of those things like in The Shining where it's like a vestige of the book that like is creepier because you don't have the context for it. Like in The Shining the bear costume guy.
Oh, and speaking of bears, that was, I think, the best part of
Annihilation. Oh, yeah. Tess liked the bear a lot.
Yeah, I loved the bear.
I feel like it's a good litmus test, like to know what's scarier to you, the green suit at the end or the bear, because I think that everybody I have talked to who's seen this movie, it's one thing or the other. Like one thing upsets them more.
So Jennifer Jason Leigh goes Annihilation, and then she turns into like prismatic rainbow matter. And then what I thought that meant was I thought, oh, you become the shimmer. Like,
yeah,
the shimmer is people. Yeah. And then it was like, no, it's an alien.
Well, I mean, I think that's how the alien manifests itself, right?
I guess. But then it's like, and then someone comes out in a fetish suit and does like a tango.
The dance. The modern dance. I mean, look,
it was
good, but it was bad. You know, I mean, that's kind of
it
like...
It was good, but it was bad. We watched it with our friend Brendan Whalen, who used to do the social media for a fetish wear site. And he was like, it's just a Zenny suit.
Well, you guys, I'm willing to fill in more of that scene for you if you're open minded about it. I don't suppose that you've written anything that I've written about it on the internet. So I'll be happy to repeat myself here.
We read your Vulture article, both of us.
Yeah,
and we both Tess was like, this isn't a drug movie.
I did not think it was a drug. Well, it was 11:20 in the morning, but you know, I went in with an open mind. And I still didn't feel like it was a drug movie.
I don't think it's a drug movie. I'm in a drug movie. Well, that was in my first piece that I wrote about it. But like, I don't think it's a drug movie in that it is about drugs. But I think it's like maybe destined to be the kind of thing that you show somebody at a dorm room at 4 a.m. Like that kind of movie.
Yeah, but you know what? Like then I went home and watched Stalker and I was like, you know, Stalker is like a more psychedelic movie, even though there is no rainbow fungus in it. It's like it's paced better. It is scarier. Just like this was fine. It was okay. But you know, when I realized it was Alex Garland, I also really liked Ex Machina, which mm-hmm. Tess I think did not like.
No, it's again the interpretive dance, which is the same actor. Oh, yeah. I believe
Oscar Isaac and interpretive dance. Yeah, which I know. Two checks on your list. But you know, I did really like Ex Machina. I don't know why I was underwhelmed. Maybe because you built it up and I thought it was going to be great.
Well, I didn't build it up because I would say that I would give this, if I had to do a star rating, which I never do for movies, but like it would be like a 3.5 out of 5 for me or something. I don't think that it's perfect at all. I think most of the like body of the movie is kind of poorly written. Not because of character development, but just because it's just sort of like laying out all these sort of structure and stakes things that feel much more like skeletal Hollywood structure than I think the movie really is trying to do. And I feel like that kind of undersells how kind of cosmic it goes at the end.
Can I recommend something that I read about Annihilation that I thought was a really good take on it? It appeared in Collider and it's by Matt Goldberg. And he basically is like, this is a movie about cancer. And it obviously, cancer's a through line, but the way that a cancer spreads and changes and it doesn't have like an agenda other than the, you know, innate biological agenda to self-destruct, which is also referenced a lot. But how it like mutates and changes. And then he also kind of went into like, oh, they're all women. The most common form of cancer is breast cancer. Like it was an interesting thought to play with more.
It starts with them looking at cervical cancer cells at the beginning. Like, I think that's very intentional. I mean, I think, you know, I think that this movie is also like resonating more for people who have like have, you know, dealt with depression or any other kind of self-destructive tendencies, because I think that there are people who watch that ending scene and are like, it's like out there, it's crazy. And then there are people who are like, oh my god, like I had like an extremely emotional reaction to the end.
I appreciated that it like was trying something crazy.
Yeah.
But I do think that Alex Garland has sort of like an endings problem, other than Ex Machina, which I really like the ending of. But, you know, I remembered he wrote Sunshine also, which is a movie that I really, really liked up until a certain point. And I was always like, it's like 2001 is like the acid cosmic horror movie. And then this is like the ecstasy movie.
Right.
But in Sunshine also, it ends with like, and then there's a guy, a scary guy.
You know? Yeah. Like,
and I think for me, just having it be like a scary, like a boss, you know, a level boss, instead of just being sort of like, oh, it's a mind fungus and it's not like a human being. The fact that it was like, if it had been like Tess and I were saying too, if the body had been like made of slime, we would have been much more into it.
Yeah, we wanted more slime. I mean, I guess we thought we were looking for slime because we were like, maybe Emily's like, in
maybe
it
it's
because
slime. Because Tess was like, why did Emily want us to see that so badly? I don't understand. But yeah, the part where like the suit thing is kind of like grinding on her and trying to become her. Like I 100% thought it was gonna be like, oh, it turns into slime and like takes her, you know. But again, maybe that's just because I was thinking for blob horror.
See, I find it. Well, I mean, you know, you see that part with the like deers who are marrying each other. Basically, I think that there's something terribly unsettling, much more than a bunch of slime would be, about these sort of autopilot cells that are just mimicking the body that are you. Like the idea of being in something that feels like a fight but is not a fight because it's just you is like, I feel like a kind of constricting fear around my chest, because that sounds like a nightmare. Like that sounds horrible.
Well, I initially, when watching it, I was like, oh, it's about PTSD, because they both served in the, you know.
Yeah, scary when it had no face. That was the scariest part. There were some very scary images in this movie, including the moving guts. There were, like, a lot of things I really liked, and I appreciated how ambitious it was.
Yes.
I think I also just felt like, oh, I don't want to have to put the pressure on this movie of, like, will we ever get another, like, team of female scientists?
That's
movie.
What I meant when I said that it was, you want so badly for it to be perfect, and I think what you expect from it depends a lot on what you, the changes that you want to see in the roles that women get to play.
We were talking about another movie earlier, I don't want to out-test, but I'm going to, as she said she wasn't a fan of Lady Bird so much everyone else was, but she said also, she was like, but guys get to make, like, narcissistic movies about their lives all the time that, like, maybe aren't the greatest movie in the world, so, like, I don't want to condemn it because, you know.
Like, I liked Lady Bird, but it didn't blow me away as much as I wanted it to, and then I had to realize.
And then you felt guilty for not loving it. Exactly. Because you were like, I want it to be, like, my favorite.
And I thought the performances were incredible, and I was happy that it was there, but I think maybe it's expectations that I have that are so unrealistic to be met of, like, I want Lady Bird to be the best movie.
Right. Whereas we bring nothing to go see Paddington 2, and then I like love Paddington 2 because I have nothing riding on Paddington 2, you know?
I feel like having that attitude, especially about anything like created by or featuring women, is like, I don't know, a recipe for...
It is self-destructive.
And it's unfair also, like, because exactly, you don't come in with that expectation about...
No, it's totally unfair. And I also, like, I feel like I put this pressure on Natalie Portman all the time, too, you know, where I'm like...
Oh, that's where I differ, because I'm like, I feel like, you know, I guess I understand in a cynical way why they wanted Natalie Portman to be this character. It's not like she's not the character, but I don't think that, like, trying to sell the movie on her name alone is any kind of strategy, because I feel like people are much more excited right now in general to see Tessa Thompson and Gina Rodriguez in a movie.
Well, that too. I mean, they were like, you know, I think it's also just because she's playing this main character who's a little more of a Mary Sue and a little more a sort of like a Cypher. And then there was like the part that Tessa and I both were like, this is the best part, was when Gina Rodriguez was like, oh, we got hella footage.
Yeah.
That was the best.
Because I was like, she probably ad-libbed that, because I don't know that Alex Garland has ever heard hella. But it just felt like, you know, it was like, oh, a real person, like a character who feels like they have a life that exists before they were in this.
Well, I think one of the things that I really wanted to was I wanted it to be a much stranger movie than I felt like it was. I wanted it, like, I was just thinking when we were talking about, you know, these expectations.
That ending was too normal for you?
It wasn't that it was that there was so much formulaic plot in that movie.
I mean, yeah, I didn't need any of the backstory or the setup.
I didn't either.
I could have just been. They could have just started in Area X and just.
And I found the characters. I mean, it was not just the characters themselves, but how the like.
The expositional dialogue.
The expositional
dialogue.
The way
they were like, they were.
She cuts to feel.
Yeah, she cuts to herself. I couldn't. Not that stuff not was to kill so herself, silly to me. But to feel. That's the thing where I'm like, don't. Don't condescend a self-destructive woman.
And that's why I'm like, I would rather do away with that entirely. I would rather have those performances from the supporting characters be purely performance and not written as like, you know, she does XYZ, therefore this, because that feels so on the nose and like so literal in the way that I don't think this film is operating in a really literal way. I mean, how are you supposed to really explain the ending in an A to B manner? It's kind of all at that point.
Yeah. I wish this movie had 90% less dialogue just been a lot more plants growing into animals and becoming each other. Cause obviously I like that.
Yeah. That was great.
I don't know why, but Tess is looking up Welcome to Me on Wikipedia.
No, I'm not distracted, and it's just because when we were talking about...
that's the best movie about a self-destructive woman.
Yes, and I think it's interesting because I think every time there's a movie that is being framed as being very strange or kind of mind-bendy or something, I'm like, well, I don't know if I should recommend Welcome to Me.
You're judging it against a Welcome to Me curve.
Welcome to Me was not well-received. It was not well-received, but it was well-received by me. But it's for when you talk about a self-destructive person or a personality where you have that, you kind of identify or you see parts of yourself in a very extreme characterization of a person. Welcome to Me it didn't rely on anything familiar, but it painted a very specific and, it was a very full portrait of a self-destructive person, maybe not completely successful. But I mean, I wanted something where the characters, I really have a hard time with the she wears long sleeves and she cuts herself to feel, because I'm like, that's just kind of, it's condescending.
You plucked it out of a catalog almost.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tess has a lot of tropes that she cannot deal with, mm-hmm. which I respect. And one of them is people using a stage brush, people sweeping in a scene.
It's sweeping the floor. That was my main issue with Horace and Pete.
Which they don't ever really do a lot of on Cheers, surprisingly.
No, they don't. No. It's wiping the bar, and I don't have no problem with wiping the bar. The bar gotta be wiped, but the floors, when you see someone sweeping a floor and you look at the floor and you realize that there's nothing there and there's no pile and there's nothing to sweep, it takes me out of it.
More dust.
We're pro cosmic horror.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that it should have just been weirder if that's the main complaint, because I think that, I mean, for the same reason I'm saying that I kind of resist this wanting to read it as this victory because it's about five strong women. I'm like, well, women should also have stories about like cosmic dissolution too, because that is and usually that is just men get to experience that in movies, and I feel like people are afraid to put women through that kind of thing fully in a movie because it feels they're weak and we need to always show strong women in movies. And I feel like in something like this, it's so much more.
Yeah. And I enjoyed it more certainly than I enjoyed seeing Jennifer Lawrence get the shit beat out of her and Mother.
Oh my God.
There are things about that movie that I liked, but I also, could have done with more Zenny suit dancing.
Wait till you see Jennifer Lawrence get the shit beat out of her in Red Sparrow.
Do you think she has Brendan Fraser itis, where she wants to get beaten up in movies as a self-destructive tendency?
It's very possible.
It's very possible. Well, I mean, we should... all actresses. It's you're a little bit a masochist.
All actors, too. Let's be honest.
Guys, let's take another night call.
Let's do a night call.
So we have another night call, night email, I guess, if you will, that also happens to double as a Fraser Minute. Tess, you want to read it for us?
Sure. So this comes from Kate, and she writes, "Dear Night Call, I actually already left you two voice messages about two different things, but this also just occurred to me. I was too embarrassed to call back a third time. I'm so grateful that you all provide regular Fraser banter. So my question is, have you ever tried to cast the role of Maris? The first person that comes to mind for me is Parker Posey, but that's never felt quite right. Despite the entire point of Maris being that she is vividly described but never seen, I can't quite seem to picture her. Is it possible? Is it like trying to imagine the face of God? Thoughts?"
Great question.
Yeah. That was a good one, Kate.
That's
Thank you.
Such a tough question, because it is like trying to imagine the face of God, right? I almost don't want to, I understand why Parker Posey, especially because of her in Best in Show. But I feel like Maris is almost transparent. I always imagine her as being a frail ghost.
I have maybe an answer.
Okay.
So as everyone knows, I've been watching all the Cheers in the world,
mm-hmm.
And I realized from watching Frasier prequel Cheers that the device, the Maris device of the off-screen character, is actually from Cheers, in reference to Norm's wife, Vera.
Oh, right, 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 right.
But it's talked about a lot. I also have realized that everything I've ever liked about any sitcom is from Cheers. Everything I liked about Friends was actually stolen from Cheers.
Why did it take you so long to watch Cheers? It's so strange.
I kind of can't believe you never watched it
before. So I was always like, why would I want to? I don't like hanging out in bars in real life.
But didn't your parents watch Cheers?
No, I didn't watch sitcoms until the 90s. There's like a blank period where I didn't know anything about culture.
The artist devoid of sitcoms.
I watched Sesame Street and read nerd books. And then I insisted on watching Full House.
Cheers was the first show that I remember watching alongside my mom and not understanding, but like laughing along with the laugh track to prove that I got it. So, I mean, I didn't remember much about that initial viewing, but I remember like all the characters and the vibe and everything. But yeah.
Yeah. My parents watched Twin Peaks.
Oh, nice. But wait, so who would you cast as Maris?
Oh, so I was watching Cheers and there's an episode where I'm in the Rebecca years now, which are, you know, it's a different show, but it's fun. Rebecca's sister came on and she was played by Marcia Cross.
Ooh, I know. I remember this. Oh,
yeah. As her like slutty sister who always steals her men. And Sam tries to set them up into a, you know, he tries to play them off each other. And I thought Marcia Cross would be a great Maris, actually.
That's a really good call.
She's see-through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's very, very skinny and sort of patrician looking and scary.
Yeah.
But I do also think you can't really, I think Maris is the person thing from the end of Annihilation.
You should totally. Cast, I feel like it would be interesting to cast against type. I think
my Maris pick, the person whose face usually comes into my mind, is Jane Addams, weirdly.
That makes sense too, because she appears on Frasier later as someone else.
And nice. She's just got these big, yeah, she is on Frasier, that's right. She's got too, these big eyes. And
am I allowed to say too ethnic? What? She's like too, she's not like waspy enough, is my feeling. Because I feel like she looks too like a real person.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say Mercedes McCambridge, but that's like a big time hop.
Who's that?
Mercedes McCambridge wasn't Orson Welles called her the world's greatest living actress. I'm relying heavily on my phone this podcast. But so she was the voice of the demon in The Exorcist.
Okay. All right.
But also wasn't she Annie Hall's grandmother? Grammy Hall.
Comes
Am I
up
making
a lot.
That up? I'm gonna look.
I like the idea that Maris is actually like very old.
Well, I'm saying I would time hop.
But I mean, also, like, I 100% would believe that Maris would not necessarily be like either because she's like, you know, she's like our World War theorist. Like she might not be the most eligible.
Yeah,
debutante.
Couldn't you see? And Niles is totally her beard that she marries.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But also, like, couldn't you see Niles in, like, a Harold and Maude situation?
Yes.
And then it's just, like, 20 yeah. years later and they're still together?
Yeah.
Well, that was a great question. Let's take it to, speaking of self-destructive, sadistic tortures, I made Tess and Emily watch Darren Brown, The Push, which is a Netflix special from the magician Darren Brown, who is a mentalist and a famous person in England, but not here. And I feel like this was his first attempt to cross over into America.
And what an attempt.
Can I say that the title Darren Brown, The Push sounds like a sex toy?
I mean, Darren Brown, The Push is a reality TV special that is best described as like a serious Nathan for You.
Deathly.
Where you try to socially condition someone to agree to push someone off a roof at the end of like a long night in which you've gotten them to agree to do all these different other demeaning things leading up to getting them to murder somebody. Guys, nope. What'd you think?
Nobody was actually murdered, but that it doesn't mean that it didn't feel like somebody was.
Yes.
I guess.
I'm so mad at you for making me watch this, Molly.
That's because I'm the Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
Like, welcome.
Annihilation. I did not watch this all the way through, I will admit, first of all. I watched a lot of it. I watched over half of it.
Well, then you missed the ending.
I did. Have to cop to the exact same. I could not. Yeah.
Did you look up to see what happened?
Yeah, no, I looked up to see what happened. And
okay, guys, he didn't do it.
Yeah, he tried to get somebody else to do it.
No, he just didn't do it. He just said, like, no, this is wrong. I won't do it. And then they cut to the three other people they did it on, and they all do it.
shaking my head.
No, it's amazing. It's like reverse edited because you're like, this guy's totally going to do it. And they lead all the way up to it. And then at the end, they're like, you have to do it. You have to push him off the roof. And he's like, no, I'm not going to. This is fucked up. I don't believe in, like, I don't want to do it. I don't care. Like, it's not worth it to me. I'm leaving. And you're like, oh. And then they're like, oh, but also we ran this experiment three other times. And then they just show you one after the other, the people being like, oh, no. Oh, God. Oh, they just push them. And they, like, cover their mouths. And
so I feel like we can get to a deeper I want to maybe not discuss this right away about the veracity of all of this. But I feel like those three other contestants could have easily been not real. Like, maybe Chris, well, the guy
could be
here.
Not real.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, before we get into that whole aspect of it about if it's even real.
Well, it's
real.
Like the TV show Cheaters. It's
right.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's a thought experiment, and the way it makes you feel. Like, the fact that you guys both reacted, like, so violently.
It worked. We got pushed.
You got pushed.
I actually found they have kind of a button at the beginning that is a different social. It's like a microcosm of the whole thing of a man receiving a call at a cafe, and the man is not an actor, but everyone around him is an actor. And Darren Brown and his friend or coworker, I don't think they're friends, who knows, the other guy he's with, they call this person in the cafe and they instruct him to steal a baby carriage because they say, you know, that baby's been kidnapped and we're the police. You need to bring the baby out of the cafe. So the guy does exactly what they say, and he brings the stroller outside the cafe going like, this is crazy, I don't feel right about this, but he's doing it anyway. And I was so immediately disturbed because there's a Truman Show aspect to it of, mm-hmm. You eliminate, you know, anyone, nobody around this man is acting in good faith. And so yeah. That's
fascinating. It's fascinating because in the social, okay, so first of all, these are all people who signed up for a reality show, went through a barrage of like psychological tests to prove they could be on a reality show, and then were told they didn't get the job, and then the reality show starts. So it's like David Fincher's a game.
Yeah.
It's like, they auditioned for a reality show, if any of them at any point, and even though everyone around them is acting like an actor, like acting very actory, which is also hard, like impossible to tell from British.
Yeah, no, I thought everybody was such a bad actor. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, but like if anybody were like, am I in a reality show? Yeah. Like, is this all a setup, like constructed to get me to push someone off a roof to their death? Like, then you'd sound crazy.
The
meticulously kind of the premise.
Recreated corpse is the best actor of anybody. And that thing was like, that's low-key the biggest achievement of the show is that corpse. Which
Also, Tessa and I saw a preview before Annihilation for the Steven Soderbergh movie Unsane.
Oh my god, we're so gonna
and
see Unsane.
That is for sure a night call.
Yeah. I think I'm gonna see it in a couple weeks, so we should definitely talk about it.
Darren Brown is like, he's a mentalist, and all of his magic is sort of about social conditioning and linguistic programming and how you can like convince people to do things if you talk to them in a certain way and if you like repeat words over and over again.
You can't see it right now. I'm doing like a big jack off motion.
I can hear it.
Yeah.
Weep womp, weep womp. He's super famous in England, and he's also like a genius at close-up magic and like regular magic. But I mean, you know, the end of the show is he's like, don't be a fascist. Like, don't do stuff just because people tell you to. Because like, even though you think you're helping, you might not be. And like, listen to the voice in your head of like why you're doing things instead of just doing things because you think you should.
But he underwent. I mean, the manipulations and the lengths that he went to. It's hard because if it weren't a reality show and it were an experiment, it would be very, very different.
Okay, yeah. Well, in what way does this like, at what point does this diverge from anything that resembles anything a normal human's going to go through in life?
Like, so I feel like if you signed up for one at this point, you would know that maybe you were going to get like mega pranked. You know,
I don't think that means
he probably has like a shadow LLC or something. No,
he did one. There's one about the apocalypse that's really amazing.
Yeah, that sounds good.
That one's really fucked up because it's a kid whose family are like, he's a layabout, and like we're all tired of his shit, so they all conspire to like help do the con on him, which is the scariest thing
of
all, because
it's
like Rosemary's Baby, everyone you know is in on it, and they're your family.
Oh my god.
But they're they're like, he all he does is like fucking fuck around on his computer. So they start, it's very Black Mirror, they start like seeding his computer with fake news stories. And like his phone, and it's like the computers in their house all have these fake news stories that like lead up to a sort of 28 days later situation, but like nobody, you know,
I hate everyone that. Honestly,
hey, I mean, the
question is, what does this do to the person, the subject of this show? Yeah. I mean, if you actually had to put yourself through, you know, coming to a place where you thought you were pushing a human off a building.
I mean, look, they all volunteered for a Darren Brown show. I don't think that. And they're all, and then Darren Brown comes out at the, Darren Brown comes out at the end, and they're all like so happy to see him, and they're just like, oh, girl, I love you.
Well, that's a social experiment that you're a person who is, you know, pretending that you're illuminating these truths about humanity, but maybe you're just kind of stoking your own ego.
Well, he's like a weird con man in, you know, I mean, I don't know if he's a genius in like the Ricky Jay way, you know, he's definitely like a manipulator.
I think the thing that I find to be the most disingenuous about it is this like kind of underlying message that he's saying that is going on about like, don't be a conformist, like don't let yourself get wrapped up in a fascist.
It's like, don't get in a crazy Truman show where everyone's lying to you.
But it's I feel like there are so many of these like dog whistles in it that are actually way more appealing to like men's rights activists and stuff, because it's all about, here's a compliance mode. It all feels very pickup artisty and like,
I totally
how
agree.
To manipulate okay. people to like get what you well, want, maybe. How to be alpha and shit. And I
no,
find
for sure,
so
and
gross.
a lot of that Frank T.J. Mackey stuff, the real Frank T.J. Mackey, whose name I forget, but who once got mad at me for doing a blog post about how his thing is literally to be like linguistic program people by getting them, like, you just say like below me, you say like, could you reach that soda below me, and you just say it like over and over again, and it's like you're programming them to want to blow you.
Who would ever say, could you reach that soda below me?
So,
and what?
That's what I'm saying. It's a dog whistle. Like, soda. Guys, this is a women's rights activist podcast.
Yeah, exactly. We're WRA all the way over here.
WRA.
I have to say, like, it was a different time, but I used to watch Pickup Artist and thought it was an interesting experiment. It was obviously horrible. Horrible, and it made me feel rotten inside. But I was like,
but
this
didn't
is...
you like Mindhunter?
Yeah, I've been liking Mindhunter.
Okay, so you like thinking about like the rotten parts of the human brain that
for
make
sure.
people do fucking crazy things.
But
is it just if it's real or fictionalized?
Well, this is the thing, is it felt, you know, my mixed feelings about The Bachelor, for instance, of how you kind of, you know, take these people, you put them on a show, you create very strange circumstances that they are forced to adapt to. They have real emotional responses to things that are constructed. There's like an ambivalence there. But then when you take someone, it's essentially emotional torture to prove a point. And I don't think that the point was necessarily proven. And I also think that, you know, it made me very nostalgic for, I shouldn't be nostalgic for it because it's ongoing. But Nathan, for you, where I would expect to feel that same kind of like, oh, I feel morally uncomfortable with this, but I don't, because the motive is not to exploit
or embarrass
someone or embarrass somebody.
I know a lot of people who can't deal with that kind of comedy in general because they're like too afraid they'd be the mark, you know?
But
they're,
it's not like, only that. It's so hard to watch someone who is trying to do the right thing, but the whole frame is that it will be the wrong
thing.
Well,
I guess the point is that it's hard to do the right thing and people don't care if you do. So, like, in that situation, it's like everyone's telling you to push someone off a roof. Do you not do it? Because you're like, no, I still know that's wrong.
Yeah. I guess I just can't get past the actual stress of that he's going through. Like, I think that that's a traumatic experience that they put him through. I don't feel like it's for any, like, particularly enlightening outcome, because I think
it's
like
applicable to groups. It's just about group psychology and
but I think it's stuff like nothing. I feel like that hasn't been like it's like a big Milgram experiment, basically.
Mm-hmm. It is exactly that's what's interesting about it. I'm like, you can do a Milgram experiment on British television.
I mean, I like
only on British television.
They'll let you do anything on British television.
I thought that one thing that was very thought provoking and, you know, occurs like pretty early in the push, if you have any interest in seeing it but are ready to duck out, is when they're doing the auditions, I guess, that everyone will be told they fail, but they didn't. they have a bunch of actors and then they invite in some actual just real people who don't know what's going on and they ring a bell.
Oh, I had
and
to skip this.
Every time the bell rings. Oh, yeah. Well, I was like, this is interesting. Every time the bell rings, the actors stand and the people who don't know what's going on, it takes them a while, but eventually they just start mimicking the behaviors of the actors.
Right. Well, isn't that like Annihilation too? It's just like human beings are just animals, man.
They just adapt.
We're just Pavlovian dogs, man.
I mean, I think that there are more interesting things that could have been done with this idea than punishing someone this as much as they did. I mean, it really, I think you have to be at such a distance from someone else's humanity to think that it's worth that cost to make the point.
Yeah, I don't think it's a victimless show, I guess is how I feel in the end. I feel like those people could be, like, especially the ones, if those people did indeed go through this entire thing and then opt to kill the guy at the end and then learn that about themselves, I feel like that is... That could really fuck somebody up for their entire life, and
oh,
maybe
for sure.
Like
so
send them
a
down a really bad path.
In reality, you guys, I'm gonna make you guys watch the Haunted House documentary.
Oh, I started it and I was really liking it.
I'll make you watch that for next week
because
part
Netflix?
Of what I think is in. Yeah, okay. It's also about.
Can you
all
repeat
this stuff.
The name so everyone?
It's called Haunted. I think.
No, it's called Haunters.
Oh, it's called Haunters. I keep calling it the wrong name. It's called Haunters.
Isn't that a Pokemon?
It's about people who are really into haunted house stuff and who professionally work as haunters in haunts.
Ooh,
but again, it's
awesome.
Also, oh, you have to watch it. But it also, you're also going to be mad at me. It's going to be great.
Oh, no.
That's different, though, because I mean that I watched that right after, I just started it right after The Push. And I was like, see, these people want to be scared.
But that's what I'm saying. Those people want to be scared. Yeah. People who signed up for a Darren Brown show, at this point, they know what they might be in for because it's like the fifth one of these and the last one was like the apocalypse and the one before that was like getting people to rob a bank. So like it escalates. I wonder what the next one will be.
I honestly want to see one where it's just like, will this person eat 3 cream pies?
How yummy will their meal be?
50 Yorkshire puddings.
Do we dare? Do you dare watch something so twisted?
Yeah.
Guys, 50 Yorkshire puddings would also be torture. That's so much food. That's so much butter.
It ties back to Phantom Thread, and here we are.
All about the Hungry Boys.
Yep.
Full British breakfast. So I guess you guys don't think Darren Brown's going to cross over into America, is what you're saying?
Well, he overpronounces his name so hard that I feel like he's really trying to get his name into our minds. So maybe
he won the number one magician from the Magic Castle, like 2 years running. And
I
also,
would love to see a mockumentary with someone else playing Darren Brown.
He's a linguistic programmer, so he's just saying his name over and over
again.
Darren
Brown.
Whatever it takes. That part where they keep saying whatever it takes. So good.
Well,
this was a lovely night call.
Yeah.
This was a wonderful night call.
Thank you everybody for listening. And hey, if you like Night Call, we're a few episodes in now. I think you know what you're in for. Why not leave us a review on iTunes? Give us a rating and a review and
subscribe.
And subscribe
Do
if you aren't already, but you should be doing that by now, right? And yeah, that just helps us get the show out in front of more people's eyeballs and helps spread the word. So yeah, and if, as always, leave us a night call too if you have any questions or anything to share with us at 1240469. And you can also leave us an email at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you want to follow us elsewhere, come check us out at facebook.com/nightcallpodcast. And on Instagram at Instagram account Night Call Podcast. And on Twitter at Night Call Pod.
We'll see you in the shimmer.
Have a good night.